Heyo, and here we go. Welcome to a special episode of We Talk Podcasts. I am your host, Mr. Brett Podcast, and I am truly happy to welcome a guest who has his own podcast, who also does voice acting, Lilo and Stitch voice acting, Invader Zim. He's best known for, of course, being one of the kids in the hall. He is Kevin McDonald. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very fine, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm wonderful. And, you know, so happy to have you on the show today, being a fan of yours for very, very long time now.
And very nice, thank you.
And, you know, it's just, it's great because I know that the reason that you're on is to talk about your show at the Rivoli in Toronto on December 13th.
No, it's a chat with you.
Okay, even better. Well, I can totally do that because you know, chatting is kind of what I do.
I'm on the Rivoli on the 13th of December, two shows, Queen of Spadina, so come.
I couldn't agree more. Well, you should tell us about them. Rock opera, that seems a little out of your field.
Yeah, is that what I called it? Rock opera? I keep changing the name. sometimes I call it Kevin McDonald's rock opera. Sometimes I call it the mini rock opera. I guess the real name is Cheaters in Love.
Cheaters in Love.
Yes, and it's a rock opera written by me, though I'm not a musician. So it's not all the chords in the world in it. It's like, right now it's 45 minutes. There'll be an opening set of me doing other songs. So don't worry, there'll be plenty of show. And it's like 45 minutes of a rock opera, because I grew up loving Jesus Christ Superstar, so I always wanted to write a rock opera. And I wrote one for my podcast. And it's based on a true story that happened with Dave Foley and I and Scott Thompson in New York. And though I write Scott Thompson out, but then I give the guy playing Scott Thompson a song where he's mad at me for writing him out. And when I first did it in Seattle, the podcast, Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie played Dave, and that was very exciting.
So then is it the same one as on your podcast?
Yeah, but it's better now.
Oh, even better. Well, that's good. Yeah. You know, you've had a little more time to work with it than I guess.
Yeah, and when I start doing it next year, I've written like four more songs, so it'll be like an hour long and four more songs. Are they better? I don't know. I think it's a better story. Who cares? And the 45-minute one will be the great one, and then later when Toronto sees the week hour one, we were there. We were the better 45-minute version.
So then is the assumption then that by next year you'll be doing an hour and a half version, you'll eventually just get it up to monolithic length?
Soon it's going to be 7 hours.
Well, I mean, all the best musicals are. That's what I know, right?
I guess so, yeah.
So what, you know, when you're doing something like that, and I know you love Jesus Christ Superstar and stuff like that, but like,
I sure do.
Is there, like, how do you decide, like, yeah, you know what, musical, I'm just going to learn a few chords, I'm going to do this.
Well, I haven't, I've been writing songs for a while. I'm not a musician. I can't tune a guitar, but I write a lot of songs for my comedy act. And I got my first guitar when I was 34 as a birthday gift, and Fender Stratocaster, because the Shadowy Men said that would be better to learn on an electric guitar. Shadowy Men are the band that played the music for a theme song for the Kids in the Hall and all the music for it.
That's right.
And,
yep.
And they said, good, I won the quiz. I'm right. Thank you. And I said it'd be easier to learn an electric guitar. Don't get an amp, because you won't be able to play that well enough. So I did get an amp anyway, eventually. And I learned that, and then it was true. When I got acoustic guitars, when I was like 36, they hurt your fingers. But I got a Beatles fake book, and I learned a lot of Beatle chords and Bowie fake books. And so there's a lot of B-flat minors in the rock opera, which is all over the Space Oddity song, David Bowie. There's a lot of David Bowie chords and a lot of there's a lot of G7s, which is totally Beatles.
Well, I mean,
I've been writing songs forever, but I'm sorry, I cut you off. What are you about to say?
Oh no, I was going to say, I mean, if you're going to borrow from somebody, then borrow from the best, right?
The two B's and Brian Wilson. I try to, but he's so over my head; it's hard to.
Yeah, Brian Wilson is amazing. There's no question about that. I am a huge fan.
So I mentioned the Beach Boys in the rock opera.
Well, I mean, you know, that's super important in my opinion. But now, when you're out there, like, I mean, because you also do a lot of other things. I mean, I mentioned the voice acting, and of course, there's the performing on stage. Whether it be, yes, like, I mean, because you were recently just in Calgary doing a comedy show.
Yes, I just flew back there on Monday. I was just there performing at the Laugh Shop and teaching a workshop at the Alexander Writing Society.
So, well, I'll ask this first then. When you teach a workshop, what's that like? What's that about?
Well, it's like I have a few different workshops now, but and I go like two or three weekends a month, and I go to, it's usually an improv theater, and I teach workshops during the day, and at night I perform. So I'm like a traveling comic. It's like the Bob Dylan Never-Ending Tour, and the main workshop that I do is the Old Kids and the Hall Method. I teach how to write comedy sketches through improv. Because when we were a stage troupe and we didn't have computers, touch computers was just a crazy thing in the movie War Games, so we didn't write anything down, and we had to write through improv and memory. And later, when we got the TV show, they introduced us to that wonderful thing called computers, and we wrote that way. So I also have a workshop with straight writing. That's the one that I did this weekend in Calgary. And then I have an acting and sketch comedy workshop. But my favorite one is the thing How the Kids in the Hall Started, writing through improv.
So then, as you're performing and doing these different outlets for yourself, like, is there like kind of a different set of muscles that you use to do each performance? Because I mean, I would imagine that voice acting is significantly different than performing on stage.
Yeah, they're similar muscles. They're similar muscles. Like voice acting, when I was first starting in the late 90s, I read an article with Tom Hanks, who had just done Toy Story, and he said that it's more tiring than filming a movie. And I thought, oh, that sounds good, but that's not true. But it is true. It's really trying, like, even though you're not usually there for more than an hour or two, sometimes you do video games, it's longer, but even the hour ones are tiring, especially me, because I usually play high-pitched dogs that roll down the stairs a lot, so I spend a lot of the hour going, ow, ow, ah, ah, and it's, like, really tiring, and you try to act it out, too. It's fun, and speaking of different muscles, it depends who's recording the cartoon. I do usually Disney or Nickelodeon, and they do completely differently. Nickelodeon, you record with the whole cast. And that's fun. That's a different muscle because you're ad-libbing and you're having fun. They're not the kids in the hall, but God bless them. They're good. And you have fun. But at Disney, they do it. They try to honor Walt, and Walt Disney always thought that you did the act. You recorded the actor by themselves, each actor by themselves, and that's fun in a different way. It's sort of like a kid in the sandbox that you get to play all by yourself, and you still think of ad libs, and they're kind of weirder and more creative in a way. I like both ways. It's two different sets of muscles, to use your phrase.
Yeah. So they're giving you the opportunity at least to kind of explore the character and to go off on your own a little bit.
Yeah, they're both fun in different ways. They're like social fun and antisocial fun.
Yeah, because I think that it's such a fascinating element. And I mean, obviously your history of comedy and being able to do improv and stuff like that. Now, how long did it take you to learn improv? Like, did you think that you were funny and good at improv right off the bat? Or was that like did that take you quite a while to learn?
Quite a while, like decades actually, because I started as a teenager in Second City workshops. Well, I guess I first started doing it in high school theater arts and college. College seemed easier because everyone else, how do I put this? They weren't funny. And so it was very easy for me to be, and they didn't teach you the rules really in college, improv. They just told you to improvise because they were using it as a tool for actors. So I thought I was good at first because I was funny. But being funny in improv doesn't necessarily mean you're good at improv. And then I went to Second City. I remember being so nervous. This was like 1981. And I thought John Candy was going to be there teaching. I didn't know because it was in Toronto. But it wasn't. It was teachers, Alan Gutman. And there were rules. I was so nervous on the first day there, on the subway there, I wrote jokes that I would use on stage if I had to, which is the worst thing you can do in improv. And I never used those jokes. But that's how nervous I was. But you learn rules. Like the most important rule is never say no to anyone. Don't deny. Don't block is what we used to say in the 80s. So if someone comes up to you and says, Hey, what's that snake doing on your shoulders? You don't say, what snake? Because that kills the flow of the scene. It's called yes anding. So I'll just give you an example. I'm not going through every rule, I swear. So if someone says that to you, I say, yes, and what's that monkey doing on your shoulders? And then the scene starts. It's a more positive. Some people see it as a religion, like a yes and kind of thing. And so you learn rules like that. And there's millions of things. And then you find it's actually easier to be funny within the structure, within the rules. And then you learn to break the rules while working within the rules. And that's when the really interesting work happens. And I forget your original question. And then Kids in the Hall, when we were stage crew for a year before we were discovered by Lorne Michaels, we always did like 10 or 11 sketches in our show. We did a show of new sketches every Monday. But we had two halves. So the Rivoli, the place where we played, where I'm playing this Friday, December 13th, at the Rivoli, so they could sell drinks. And we always had an improv in each half. And I realized I was good enough to know that I was bad. I knew that I could be funny in it. Bruce and I thought we could just be funny in improv, even though I knew the rules. Scott was a wild card. He could be brilliant, he could be horrible. Mark and Dave were not only funny, but they were actually good improvisers. And so when I started these workshops, because as I say, I do workshops during the days and shows at night. The show's usually me doing stand-up, and the students do their new sketches that we created in the workshop that day. And then I improvise with the theater troupe. And at first I was petrified. I mean, I remember like for the first year where people were saying, oh, it's so good to see like a famous person nervous. But then, so it was when I turned 50 when I started getting comfortable finally doing improv. And I finally feel I'm sort of a good improviser. I have bad nights where I'm not so good. But I'm sort of more of an improviser now. I'm closer to Mark and Bruce. Mark and Dave now.
So then what is the monkey doing on your shoulder then?
He's making me lemonade. That's why he's squeezing lemons into the glass that I'm holding for him.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, that's good. I love lemonade. So.
Yeah, he's my lemonade monkey.
Lemonade monkey.
Do you want me to get my orange juice monkey? Do you want to? All right, stop it, Kevin. That was us improvising.
Perfect. Love it. My next question then is, like, it also has to do with being funny and stuff like that. Like, how do you know, especially for your comedy show, how do you feel like when something's funny when you write it?
Oh, like how do I know it's funny?
Yeah.
How do I know? Well, first of all, deep down, I know that I'm like it's an opinion. I know that I'm never totally right or wrong. But I know when I think it's funny. And sometimes, because when you're writing comedy, it's so much harder, I bet, than drama. Drama, you just write, and then you stage it, and people have different opinions. They liked or they didn't. Who can really tell? But comedy, people know. You've got to, when you're writing it, you've got to write like three laughs a page, at least. We're noisemakers, so it's harder. And sometimes, like, I'm blocked. I never really blocked, but sometimes I don't go to the next page even though the story's okay because I haven't got enough laughs. And when true inspiration happens and I surprise myself, no way can I guarantee that I'll get a laugh on stage, but I know that I've just pleased myself and I know I'm happy with it. But sometimes I just need to get those three laughs a page, so I do something that the audience, oh, I know the audience will laugh at this, but I don't like it. Or I don't know if the audience will laugh at this, but I got to put some kind of funny thing in. So you get, as you write more and more, you get really strong opinions, at least of what you think.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you find that you set aside time to write things? Because I know we've talked to a lot of musicians, and they certainly set aside time in their day to write songs. And so it's like, is that kind of the same with comedy? Do you have like an idea just at the grocery store, and then you'll be like, oh, I should write that down? I mean, of course, you're too big to go to a grocery store yourself, but you know
no,
what I mean.
No, I have two men who carry me to a grocery store.
Oh, well, of course.
Two men who carry the grocery. I'm always writing. Like for my podcast, I write sketches and stuff like that. And I'm always writing rock operas and things like that. But I'm also writing a pilot right now with Norm Hiscock, who was a writer in the Kids in the Hall show, like one of my best friends. And I'm also writing a movie with Kelly Macon, who's our director of Brain Candy and directs some of our best sketches. Here's to answer your question, betterly, I've invented a word.
Of course.
Betterly, is that, ideas come pouring out. I have hours and hours of audio on my phone when I think of an idea. There's millions of things I won't get to. If I get to one of them before I die, that'll be amazing. Short stories and books. Right now I'm focusing, besides the smaller things like writing my comedy stand-up and writing podcasts and sketches and stuff like that, I'm writing a TV show and a movie. And so what I do is I stay in the office basically. When I'm at home, when I'm not out shooting something or flying and then working on the weekends, like today, I did this before, and I'll do this after when I get off the phone with you, is I stay from 9, I leave a lot of times for lunch and chores, but basically I the office from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., unless stuff comes up. Lots of times I'm outside doing stuff, I swear. I'm not lying. Yeah. And then I write when I have to. I know when I want to, and when I have to, I'm also producing my next few, I'm booked until June of 2020, and so every day there's 7 or 8 emails with different theater owners asking me questions or setting things up like that. So that is how I spend my day in my office, which I am pacing right now.
Now, is
office
this
in my house? I'm not so rich that I can afford an office.
Is this something that you really wanted? When you started out in your career, was that something that you were just like, I want to be insanely busy, so busy that there's things piling up on the sides of me, and just that I need to keep going constantly?
Well, maybe that's the result of what I really wanted. What I really wanted was to be writing comedy that I perform all the time. Yeah. My big dream was, because I was a kid in the 70s, was to be like Woody Allen, to write and act and direct in my own movies. And that didn't happen on that level. Not yet.
There you go. You still got time.
His best work in his 70s. It could still happen at least once or twice. But that's what I do on a lower level. I'm always writing for myself. The thing I'm worried about the book and short stories that I'm writing is that people are only going to think it's funny if I act it out for them. Because I enjoy writing better, but I realize that I write best for myself to perform it. And that is what I envisioned as a kid. Just writing for stuff that I perform, be it on film, TV, or live.
Well, and I can well imagine, just given your style of delivery and the like, that seeing you perform something would automatically just add that extra oomph to it.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, yeah, it's cheating. I'm writing for the actor. I know the actor so well. Lily Tomlin, I forget her writer's name, but she's written her one-man show since the 70s, and it's almost like writing for herself. She knows exactly what Lily can play and stuff like that. And so it's even easier when you're actually Lily Tomlin, like I am, writing for myself. Because I think of the idea by performing it in a way, whether I'm sitting or whether I'm pacing my office like I'm doing now. It's cheating when you can when you know the actor so well that you can write for them perfectly.
Now, that's an interesting thing that brings up to me is how do you remember everything? Are there cues? Is it just the fact that years of practice have helped pump this into your brain?
I'm losing my short-term memory. My long-term is better than ever, which I hear is a sign of Alzheimer's. But writing memorizing has always been hard, and now it's getting harder. When you write for yourself, it's easier because you sort of know a lot of your thinking. But the mini rock opera that we're doing, it's a reading performing because there's no way I can memorize lyrics and not only when you sing, not only do you memorize lyrics, but you have to know when to sing them. When it goes to the G, or you wait two beats after you hit the G and stuff like that. So I can do that. But I did my one-man show in Broadway in New York in August. I'm doing Los Angeles and San Francisco in January. And I have to re-memorize it again. And that's, even though I wrote it, that's sort of hard work. But the hardest thing, I'm doing in Florida, there's this famous place in Central Florida, Tallahassee, where they have Shakespeare in the Park festival in the spring and summer, and they always always get a minor celebrity every year. I'm the minor celebrity this year, and I'm playing Malvolio in Twelfth Night, and I've never really done real acting, much less Shakespeare, and memorizing it is, I know it's beautiful language and everything, but it's like memorizing well-written gibberish. I have so many monologues in one scene. It's crazy. So I'm a little afraid of that. In fact, they gave me half of the money, and I told them to send it to my agent, and they thought I was being a good guy, but I'm thinking that, oh, just in case we have to return it. I don't want to spend it already.
Yeah, put that aside just in case.
Yeah. I don't want to be sued. Let my agent put it in his agent vault, in his agent's office, and he couldn't memorize a word. We want our money back. Oh, it's right here. Don't worry.
I mean, you're so good at improv that you'll just be able to make stuff up and nobody will know the difference.
I was talking to the director today, and I said, he said things go wrong all the time. So, well, like, usually I could ad-lib, but you can't ad-lib Shakespearean language. Yeah. And he said, yes, you're right. Don't do that.
Yeah, I guess that would probably start showing you off as perhaps not knowing as much as you might need to.
He warned me, because it's Shakespeare in the Park, because it's outside, that every now and then, a train will go by, and no one will be able to hear us. So I thought, oh, all right.
I don't remember any trains in Shakespeare, but that's just me.
You remember the one in Macbeth, the 10:15 ride to the city? You don't remember that famous scene?
No. No, oddly enough. But one of the interesting things that I think, you know, Kids in the Hall was so important and so amazing. Like, I mean, just a, you know, iconic Canadian troupe. How often do you get to see the rest of the guys, and how important is it to be able to, like, maintain contact with them?
Well, it's important, and also it's impossible not to. Like, we're still a troupe. Nowadays we're more like, we're as much best friends as we're a troupe, but we're still a troupe. We know that we're going to tour every, like, 3 or 4 years. One will be coming up now, because the last one was 2015, only now we're sort of in talks, maybe doing another sketch show again. Like, we're together all the time, and we're on conference calls all the time. If it isn't about doing a new TV show or a new tour, it's about a documentary they're doing of us, or the past few years it was a book that Paul Myers wrote about us. And stuff like that. So it's impossible not to. But as we get older, we appreciate each other more, and we're not mean to each other anymore, because we're not assholes in the early 20s anymore. So it's more pleasant. So we sometimes even like to get together. What was it, 3 years ago, we all happened to be in Los Angeles. Like, we've all lived there different times, but we never lived there at the same time. Bruce organized us to come over to his place. He said, hey, I'll barbecue some food. And as we, I shared a cab with Scott, and I thought, what's this meeting about? He said, I don't know. I hope the food's good. What do we, I guess, we're, I forget what it was. Maybe it was a new TV show or something, even 3 years ago. But it'll be nice to see each other. And then we got there. It wasn't a meeting. Bruce just wanted it. We had never done that before, is my boring point. The fact and never just hung out. Like, we go in twos and threes to movies and stuff like that all the time. But the five of us just to hang out, it's a very rare thing. And we never had dinner before like that without a meeting. That was weird. But very, very nice. And we kept saying as we were going home, wow, that was nice. Wasn't that nice? We should do it more often. I'm sure we'll never do it again.
Well, I mean, that's just the way it works, right? I guess you get so used to working together that like, the idea of just, of, like, socializing almost seems weird.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark McKinney for years said, you know, we found out that we were getting a TV, like, that we had sold our pilot, and that HBO was picking us up for a TV show in 1988. And I remember near the end of the season, near the end of the series, the fifth season, which was the last season in 1994, Mark saying, we still haven't celebrated that we got a TV show yet. It was just not something that we did. We're weird, like, we're British and cold in this way. We once had a vow that we never got each other birthday gifts.
Oh,
Christmas gifts.
Why not?
And there was no reason for it, other than it was probably too much emotion involved.
Yeah.
So we never did. And now I think people do give you other people's gifts when you're, like, in the same city with them. You know, it's their birthday. I once gave Dave Foley for his birthday when we both lived in Los Angeles. Was in the mid-2000s. Brian Wilson finally, speak of the devil, had finally finished Smile, and I loved it so much I gave it to him, and I'm pretty sure he never played it once.
Well, he should, because it's awesome.
Yes. Not because I gave it to him, that's fine, because he didn't ask for it, but just because it's awesome.
Just because it's awesome. Well, I want to thank you as well for giving me a gift. You've given me lots with your comedy, but specifically, I will point out that the cat on my head scene in Brain Candy is the funniest thing maybe ever for me, and it pops up into my head at least once a week.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, when we were writing it, Kelly Macon, the director, came to me and he said, "We need a scene where your character's going through and he's finding out her in a coma. I want her in the backyard. So think of something funny in the house." And we had already thought about her being a cat lady. And I thought, well, what if there were a lot of cats in comas? And then cat in my head, cat in my head. And then that's the story of that.
And yeah, makes me laugh all the time, no matter what. Just bar none. I'll say it to people. They may not understand, but the ones who do, it's bang on.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, Kevin, I've appreciated having you on the show. I want you to tell all the folks, of course, where to find you, because, I mean, where to find your podcast. Of course, the Rivoli, I've heard that you're playing there on Friday, I think.
Not this Friday, the next
That's
Friday,
right, the 13th.
Two shows, I forget the times, 7-ish and 9-ish, I'm not sure. It'll be me with real musicians and real singers, so there'll be some good singing there, and it's kind of dark, but it's a true story.
Well, you know, that's always the best when it's a true story. You know, you got to start from somewhere, and the truth is always a great place to start.
And even though it's like 45 minutes, my friend and guitarist who's playing guitar, I'm playing the part of Dave in the rock opera, we'll do like four or five songs before the rock opera.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great show. I wish I could be there. I wish I could just get to Toronto right now. But
well, one day you'll be able to teleport there, I'm sure.
That's right, and that would be awesome. Well,
yes.
Kevin McDonald, thank you so much for coming on the show. You are a wonderful guest, a wonderfully funny man, and I appreciate it, and I hope that you have nothing but the best of success with all of your multitude of projects, and look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, Seeking Happiness is also one of my projects. I hope that one is big as well. Thank you very much.
Well, no problem. And, you know, go have a glass of lemonade from your lemonade monkey.
Thank you. And you go to the orange juice monkey.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye now.